right. Bonaparte Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, senior editor Emil Stonick interviews Andy Young, a natural winemaker from the Pacific Northwest. Andy runs a label called St. Reginald Parish because he is originally from New Orleans and is now making some spectacular wines in the wonderful state of Oregon, one of which has kind of quickly become my favorite. It's called the Marigny. We shouted it out in our December issue, Best Things We Ate and Drank All Year. It's a sort of a carbonic red, and it's delicious. And when the new vintage comes back in stores, be sure to look for it. They talk about how Andy got started as a musician, how he became interested in making wine, what his process is like, and how it has changed over the years. After that, I chat with senior food editor Chris Morocco about a new recipe he developed for BA.com, spicy sweet sambal pork noodles. While he was testing this recipe, the entire office literally could not stop eating it. All right, let's do this thing. Here is Emil with Andy Young.
Hi, Andy.
Hi.
For all of you listeners out there, I'd like to welcome you to Andy and my first date. I love Andy. I don't know if he knows that, but we don't really know that much about each other. But I will tell one brief story about Andy and my first meeting, which was at Feast Portland at the Bon Appetit after party. And Marissa introduced me to Andy. And then I found out that he makes the Marigny, which was and is like my favorite wine of all time. And I was like, also, I was naturally quite drunk. And I was like, oh my God, I love your wine so much. I think I drank all the bottles in New York City. All I want is to have that wine at my wedding. What is there any left? And he said, there are four cases left. I need one for reference for the next vintage, and I'll send you the other three. And it was the hit wine of our wedding. So it's will forever, your wine will forever be a part of my story.
How could I not?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I feel like that was like something that, you know, when we were talking a little bit earlier about this, like one of the things that's really exciting about natural wine and one of the things that really intrigues me is that there are real people behind it. People you can meet and like experience their generosity and their kind of philosophy on things and their just like way of being in the world firsthand. It isn't like, you know, behind like a like veneer or like a veil of like marketing materials and like, you know, slick photos of like people standing in front of
massive chateaus.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like there's a small timeness to it that makes it feel more exciting, I think, for a lot of people, at least for myself. So, I mean, not knowing all that much about you other than you're my man and you sent me a whole bunch of wine, what's your story, Andy? How did you get into wine? Because you're not from, so you make wine in the Pacific Northwest outside of Portland.
Yeah, about an hour outside the city, southwest.
But you did not grow up in Portland.
I didn't. My family is all from Louisiana, seven generations back, as far as I can tell, sort of. You know, we lose track of it at a certain point. But I grew up in South Louisiana. That's why the Marigny label is called the Marigny. It's a neighborhood in New Orleans, the mm-hmm. Faubourg specifically. But that really just means commune in the French. So one of the things that we wanted to do with the Marigny, or I wanted to do when I started working on the initial wines, was make something that just felt neighborhoody and approachable and swaffy and easy to get into. And, you know, you
could swaffy
drink it on the porch, you know, on a Tuesday and not worry about it too much.
So I take it that those seven generations of family that you can trace back in Southern Louisiana were not winemakers?
My father was a Southern Baptist preacher, so no.
So he wasn't like, didn't have like a deep wine cellar that he introduced you to, and that's, it's this yeah, is not
it's
one
more,
of those
more
stories.
Like a deep iced tea cellar. Yeah, so I did not grow up around it. I was peripherally around it in New Orleans, obviously, but did not grow up with it on the table, had no knowledge of it. My mother is a musician, piano player, and I became a musician, and that was sort of my path. I went to an arts magnet high school in Memphis. We had moved up there for a church. And in college, I was also playing all the way through, had a band called...
What was your instrument?
Drums.
All right. I pegged you for a drummer.
Yeah. You know, so the band was called Lift to Experience. We signed a record deal with a label called Bella Union that's owned by the Cocteau Twins.
Oh, wow.
And basically kind of were on tour for most of my 20s. And at a certain point, as most bands do, there was a massive implosion. And I spent a couple of years sort of wandering the desert.
Literally or figuratively?
I mean, I was in Austin, so nearly.
Yeah.
And just decided, you know what, I've really enjoyed my time in Portland when we were touring up there. I needed scenery change. I'm going to just pack my car and drive up there. I had a old Volvo station wagon. I, to this day, cannot believe that it made it all the way to Portland.
What year? I used to have an old
93.
Volvo. I had a 93 Volvo station wagon. What
Those
color?
Those things are tough as nails. It was like a red.
A red. Okay. I had sort like a powder blue.
Oh.
But those things, mine ran until the odometer stopped working.
Oh, totally. I sold mine to a guy in Eugene, Oregon at a certain point for more than I paid for it in Texas.
Whoa.
Oregon people
are freaks about those cars.
Love those cars.
People like pull up to you on the highway and they're like, what year?
Yeah.
How many miles you got? You're like, this is very unsafe. Our cars can't do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the Volvo D240 was the Subaru of Portland now.
Uh-huh,
you know, you go to Portland now, 80% Subarus.
Yeah.
Portland in 2007, 100% Volvo.
Yeah. Times have changed.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so you packed up your Volvo station wagon, not to derail that. And you headed for Portland.
Yeah.
Did you know people in Portland?
Not really.
No.
I mean, I had a few contacts. I had a publicist friend that had worked with us in the Northwest that sort of set me up with a place to live. It was really cheap back then. It was before the sort of boom happened. It was right in that time period.
What year are we talking about?
2007.
Okay.
So like Le Pigeon had just opened up. It was the food scene was in its infancy as far as what has happened to it over the last 12 years. And I knew not much about food and was really more interested in maybe writing about music. My degree is in English. Thought I would sort of transition into a more journalism kind of role and stop playing drums all the time. And I got a job at a wine bar to kind of make ends meet while I was trying to build my portfolio of writing.
So was that your first food service job? Had you worked at other restaurants and bars and stuff like that?
My first job in Memphis was washing dishes at a little soul food cafe.
Uh-huh.
And then my second job, and I was coming up in the world, was waiting tables at Shoney's.
All right.
Yeah.
Shoney's. So you weren't like, it wasn't like totally out of the blue that you were taking a job at a restaurant.
I mean, I was interested in it.
Yeah.
For sure. And had bartended at kind of the local rock club
in
Denton, Texas, where I went to college. So bartending didn't feel that much of a stretch. But this place was essentially a small plate restaurant, sort of farm to table, very early beginning stages and that kind of stuff. It was called Terroir.
Uh-huh.
And it was just early stages of those kind of places kind of popping up in Portland. The wine list was all Pacific Northwest. So it was Oregon and Washington only. And I just fell in love with it, like right off the bat. And even though I didn't think I want to be a producer, I want to work in the industry, that took a few years. But I did develop a desire to want to taste all the time.
Yeah.
And going to tastings and started to go out to the valley. And about 3 years, 4 years later was when I thought, I'm going to work a harvest. I'd moved back to Texas to work on a record with my former bandmates. That was sort of complete. I had taken a job in the advertising industry with my degree and worked a few years as a copywriter.
Yeah.
And developed some design skills. That's how the labels are done.
Oh, so you make the labels?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in the end, I just said, I want to get back to something that feels a little more physical. I think all those years of drumming sort of made me want to be up and about and sort of doing something with my hands.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because I feel like there is so much, the kind of like music wine connection feels like really rich. Like there are a lot of people who are into, you know, well, drinking wine, but like making wine, or, you know, a lot of people who kind of have like ended up in the like professional wine world are people who were in music or still are, have one foot in music. And there's something about that kind of like the physical and the like sublime, you know, you're like actually, it is a made product, but you know, made by people and their hands and their physical labor to this like kind of weird extent.
I have a lot of people talk to me about the connection between the music and the wine.
Yeah.
I think that when you're first starting out and I didn't come from a wine background, obviously. You know, I started late. I was 34 when I did my first harvest. You know, I've been playing drums and been in the advertising industry, and there was really no time to go to school and figure it out. I just had to kind of jump in with both feet. I did a couple of internships. I stayed with my mentor for two harvests while I was making the first couple of vintages of St. Mm-hmm. Reginald. And by 15, when the first vintage of the Marigny came out, that was when I think my idea about what I wanted to do with it and what I could have to say with it was just starting up.
Yeah.
You know, it's the experimentation piece. Aside from its craft and its art, there's also a piece of, we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're okay with that. In a way, we're more than okay with that.
Yeah.
Because we want to be surprised by what's on the other side of it.
Totally. And there's that, you know, I feel like that's the kind of tension between like control and the just the possibility for like magic and beauty and whatever. It's like, I feel like that is, you know, also with music and wine, it's like you have a certain kind of control, but you're also like working with people and, you know, all of these other factors and variables that kind of overwhelm the ability to control anything and make it exactly what you first thought it was going to be.
Absolutely. And the craziest thing about making wine is that you only get to practice it once a year.
Right.
You know, in a way, I'm putting out, this vintage was number 6 for me, and I'm putting out a dish that I've only tested 6 times.
Right, right.
You know, like every year I'm trying to perfect it. And for me, that means emotionally.
Right.
You know, there is no mountaintop, you know, this is what is perfect. Every year the line moves a little bit.
Right.
It's really just what emotionally moves you. But you only get to do it that one, you know, 4 or 5 week period when the fruit is coming in. And then you have to kind of take notes and take mental notes and hope that, you know, when it comes around next year, you can apply some of those principles instead of, hey, tomorrow when we practice, let's take this thing that we kind of fell into and work on it again.
Totally. I mean, I think that to me is the thing that's so fascinating about, you know, it's like, I feel like we talk about natural wine kind of like in quotes, and it's, you know, means those two words together kind of mean everything and nothing at the same time. And I feel like people critique, or like one critique that people have of natural wine is consistency. You know, they're like, oh, it's, you know, I think about like my dad, who's kind of like an old school, like Napa wine mm-hmm. guy, you know, he's like, well, you know, it's like, you know, I feel like when you're not, you know, you have these kind of like smaller producers, whatever, the wine is less consistent. And to me, I feel like I'm like, hell yeah. You know,
great.
Well, that's the thing that's cool. That's like why people see live music, because you're like, maybe something different's going to happen this time. And maybe it's going to be like, maybe you're going to want like one vintage more than the other, but it doesn't mean you don't want to see both shows, you know?
Absolutely. And that's, you want both shows at the same time. That's, you know, when you start collecting bottles and you can open them together and have verticals of stuff and really see the arc of it. You know, I think that it's also a misnomer that natural wine can't age.
Right.
You know, you can completely do verticals of natural wine through the years, even the Marigny wines, which are meant to be had on vintage, essentially.
Right.
You know, vintage variation is key.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
You know, that every vintage is an album.
Right. Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's like listening to live shows of the Dead or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
you're like, I'm listening to the same people and the same songs in different places at different times, at different, and then the way you listen to it, like when you're listening to it, why you're listening to it, like all of that kind of like comes together to make this experience that is more than just kind of the same grape squished the same way.
Absolutely.
Like put in the same, you know, vessel and then put in the same looking bottle.
Sure. And there are environmental factors.
Totally.
Obviously, you know, was it raining the day that we picked? Was it cold? Was it warm? Was
yeah.
it sunny? You know, what was all of that like? What time did it come into the winery? When did we get it into the tanks?
Right.
But there's also the emotional piece. You know, how are you feeling about it? What have you drank over the course of the last vintage that's influenced you? And,
right.
you know, you're maybe trying to create a little more reduction. Or in 17, I was purposely trying to play with more volatility.
Yeah. What is your winemaking setup like? Because I feel like, you know, so you, I mean, do you own land? And you're not growing grapes on land that belongs to you, right?
No. I mean, obviously, I think for most of us, that's a goal at some point.
Right.
But it will never be, I don't think, a situation where we have a 100-acre vineyard.
Right.
You know, it would be 15 acres or something like that.
Right.
My setup is essentially a lease situation with the vineyards that I'm in. I have long-standing relationships with them. The more that I've been able to work with them and the more the winery has grown, the more control over the farming we've been able to have, which has been great.
Somebody else is growing grapes and you have kind of like a little parcel that you're leasing that is like their vines that they've been cultivating for years, and then you kind of are in charge of that
absolutely
portion.
And with my main site, I took 1,000 pounds from it in 2013 for my first vintage, and 1,000 pounds out of another vineyard, and put those together and had 50 cases.
Right.
This year, we took nearly 50 tons out of that same vineyard.
Whoa.
And basically have about 3/4 of the site.
So 3/4 of that site is all yours.
And I think next year we will have the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And also this coming year is the first year that all the sprays are organic and even approaching biodynamic in some form or fashion.
Right.
Just trying to use more teas, better cover crops every year, et cetera.
Cool. So you have these kind of parcels that you're leasing, that you're getting grapes from, and then come harvest, like are you out there with a team, like harvesting the grapes? Is somebody else doing that? Or
I have picked.
Yeah.
It's really hard work.
Yeah.
Generally, I pick the sparkling fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I started a sparkling program in 2015 for traditional method sparkling wine or method Champenois.
Mm-hmm.
That is now both a PetNat program and a traditional method program. But the traditional method program is still really small. It's under 2 tons of fruit that's picked, and it's impossible to get a picking crew out for that tiny amount.
Yeah.
When you're first coming up, essentially you just have to kind of piggyback onto a bigger producer's pick.
Gotcha.
And that's how you get your fruit out of the vineyard.
Right.
Or if you're, you know, cool enough with the vineyard managers, they'll let you go in there and get it.
Right, right.
So at this point, you know, with Mason Ridge, where I'm taking the bulk of my fruit from, we just go in there and pick it ourselves. You know, get a bunch of coffee, get a bunch of croissants, and show up in the morning and, you know, put a trailer on the back of my truck with some picking bins in it and just pick 2 tons and roll out.
No big deal. Just pick 2 tons and roll out.
It takes all day.
A lot of croissants and a lot of coffee.
It takes all day. If you have a picking crew do that, it's done in like 15 minutes.
Right.
It's incredible.
So you get the grapes, and then what happens? Where are you actually making the wine? Are you making it in the city, or?
I did one vintage in the city. I started at a facility in Newburgh, Oregon, which is about 35 minutes from Portland. It's, mm-hmm. it's the closest. It's out by Ponzi and Adelsheim, and it's in the Chehalem Mountains, which is kind of the first wine country town you get to when you're going down the 99 from uh-huh. Portland. That was essentially my first spot. There was a young crew of guys that were all of the same mindset in that facility. It was cheap.
So it's kind of a shared space, like a warehouse space. And
it was an old barn,
uh-huh.
essentially, that had a crush pad and an old press and a forklift that the brakes didn't work half the time. It was terrifying. And it was a great place to start, you know, because it was a little bit like having a weight on your baseball bat.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then when you get into a facility like we're at now that has like a proper press and a proper forklift and really tall ceilings and, you know, everything just feels so much easier.
Right. So doing it scrappy, kind of like trying to do your best with under all these circumstances, then you kind of level up and then you're like, oh, this is – then you push the level in other ways because like the kind of the basics of it have now become – easy and doable with like equipment that works and stuff like that.
You know, it's kind of the same principle as I've listened to interviews with old hip-hop DJs talking about learning how to scratch records on just like the worst equipment, you know, and when they finally got around to getting a proper mixer, how much faster it was and how much easier it was,
right?
Because they had learned on the hardest possible instrument.
Right. Right. Okay, so the harvest is happening, what, in Oregon in...
October.
Like October, and that's a pretty short period of time.
For me, October. These days, you know, some people are picking in late August or September. My sites are much colder. They're at the very top of the Willamette Valley. They're not near the winery. Mm-hmm. The winery now is in Eola Amity Hills, mm-hmm. and the fruit is coming from about 45 minutes north of that.
Word.
And very high elevation. Mm-hmm. So I'm picking a little bit later than mm-hmm. some people, but still our sites are not getting as ripe as even the sites that are being picked weeks before us.
Right. So it's like, you know, the fruit's good. It gets harvested. It's going to your facility. What's the like actual period of time where you're kind of like actively engaged in making the wine?
From kind of that day one, I think our first sparkling pick this year was September 9th, mm-hmm. was when we did the whole like, hey, everybody come have a cup of coffee and help us pick this traditional method fruit.
Yeah.
And it's very underripe at that point. We're picking for almost purely acidity in a lot of ways and just like the tiniest amounts of flavor that will come out later.
Right.
And then I think 2 weeks later is when we started kind of picking in earnest for Pet Nat. And then maybe a week after that, October 3rd, something like that, was when the fruit really starts coming in. You know, it feels very easy at first,
so
and then all of a sudden somebody dumps 20 tons on your pad and you're like, we're gonna be here forever.
That's, you know, and that's, I feel like the thing that like I had a really hard time wrapping my head around, and I think for a lot of people it's like you don't think about what, I mean, you know, it's like we know that wine comes from grapes, whatever, but just like actually how crazy it is that you're like, okay, we got to make wine and the fruit's got to be at this certain level of ripeness depending on what kind of wine we're trying to make, and like when it's ripe, it's ripe, and you don't get to be like, oh, I'm busy this week, I can't get it or
no.
Like right, somebody dumps 20 tons of fruit at your front door and you're like, oh, I'm actually, this week I was planning on going out of town, I can't make wine this week. It's like you got to make it right then.
Yeah.
Because it's like, that's just how it works.
It's in. It's, you know, from the moment it comes off the vine, it is on a downward trajectory towards volatility. And you either have to get it in the fermenters and, as we do with the vast majority of our fruit, start to put it into some sort of carbonic maceration.
So can you, let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about, so the your carbonic Pinot Noir, the Marigny, mm-hmm. which is the wine that I was guzzling too much of at my wedding. So how is that made? Because that is, I feel like carbonic maceration is like a word that people hear. I know what I like about, and somebody says that a wine is made with carbonic maceration, I'm like, oh yeah, I like a lot of wines like that. Because it's like you're getting something, a lot of times it's like juicy and a little bit, there's a little bit of fizz sometimes. What's going on? Like how is the Marigny made?
It's made in a very traditional carbonic way where the entire tank is filled with CO2 from the same sort of, you know, large format torpedo looking gas tanks that you see at bars or dentist office. You know, it's just got a huge amount of CO2.
So the grapes are in there, the grape juice is in there, or
cluster. I don't use a destemmer on anything.
So the grapes are going in there like on their stems, just like a bunch of grapes.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of like what you would see at the grocery store, and those are getting thrown into a big tank.
Yeah, in Pinot Noir, when it is at, you know, full sort of maturity, looks like a pine cone. Very tight. You know, it's when people first, I think, see especially Pinot on the vine, it's not this sort of loose cluster. It's very prone to mildew because the berries are incredibly close to each other and no wind can get through it. So if it gets wet, it's prone to all this disease.
Right.
And that's one of the problematic things about Oregon, and also one of the beautiful things is, you know, we're working with this very cold climate and it's slow to mature, and you are trying to fight this window of finding your ripeness before it starts to rain for 6 months.
Right. So you're kind of always at the mercy of like those conditions and all of that.
And just, yeah, kind of biding your time and waiting on that exact moment.
Right.
You know, usually we try to call a pick and hopefully 48 hours later we've got pickers out there.
Well.
But with the carbonic method, the tank gets filled with gas first.
Right, so it's a, the tank is full of just bunches of grapes
yes.
that are just piled on top of each other. How high is this tank?
I have used so many different vessels for this. It's begun in a very lo-fi way. I was at one point doing them in like essentially large picking bins, 4 foot tall picking bins, and then filling the tank with gas and then putting the fruit in and then more gas and wrapping the top of the thing with essentially restaurant cellophane. And, you know, I would take a pocket knife and poke a little slit into the top of cellophane. And if it almost knocks me out with the amount of CO2 coming back out, then I know we're safe and right. I can tape the top of it back up and the fermentation continues.
Why whole clusters? And then why the CO2? What does the CO2 do?
The CO2 is essentially sparging all of the oxygen out of the tank.
You just used a word that I've never heard before. Sparging?
Yeah. So it's just pushing all the oxygen out because it's the heavier gas.
Okay.
So then all the oxygen is removed from the tank. The fruit comes in. You continue to push CO2 in so you know that there's no oxygen in the tank at all. And that way the berries are starved for oxygen, which is how you traditionally perform a wine fermentation.
Okay.
You know, you crush the fruit, and then the yeast interacts with the oxygen to eat up the sugars and convert to alcohol.
Okay.
And that's a very normal kind of way, and you're managing the cap, which means that the I Love Lucy moment of what we call pigeage, where you're pushing it with your feet, you know, or sometimes with something that looks like a gigantic toilet plunger, you know, and you're pushing the cap into the juice because you don't want that solid matter to dry up.
Right.
Because once it does, you're prone to all sorts of volatility.
Okay.
With carbonic, each individual berry is undergoing its own enzymatic fermentation because you've driven all the oxygen out of the tank.
So they're fermenting kind of internally, like each... Each
from the inside out
is fermenting from the inside out. So like when you imagine like a piece of fruit, you know, when you get like, I don't know, like pineapple that's been in the fridge too long and it's kind of got that kind of fizzy, funky. Yeah. Like any kind of fruit that's just been sitting for a long time. It's going to start to kind of ferment.
Right.
Internally.
Because those cells have to have energy to survive the cell structure of the fruit. So it's essentially eating itself and converting itself to alcohol via, you know, an internal mechanism.
Okay, so you got this tank and it's full of carbon dioxide and berries that are or grapes that are fermenting internally.
And you know, they're hooked to the rachis, you know, the whole thing is still on the stem.
Uh-huh.
You know, and each petiole is, I think, the word. See, here's the thing is I'm still like learning. You know, I'm so young in it that sometimes I'm like, I'm using the right terminology. God, I hope I'm using the right terminology on the Bon Appetit.
But I feel like
podcast.
Oh, you know, I mean, nobody who's listening to us like, no, well, that's not true. Actually, probably some people know a lot about wine and they're gonna be like, man, he's using the wrong word. But
it's not the petiole. But I'm pretty sure it's the thing that essentially the rachis is the middle part of the stem, and then each of the little things that comes off the rachis that holds the berry.
Yeah.
Is called the petiole. And essentially you're trying to not break that because once that juice comes out of that berry, it wants to have a traditional fermentation.
Cool.
So that's one of the reasons.
Gotcha.
For
so it's like pulling the pin on a grenade. Like then,
exactly.
Then the juice just starts coming out and then it just wants to ferment the regular way. But as long as it's like still like has that little cap in it.
Yeah. Then
it's thing inside.
Totally.
So then at what point do you actually, when does it turn into juice? When do you squish it?
Well, partially, it turns into juice just from the weight of the fruit on itself.
Oh, so the fruit is just like the fruit of the weight of the fruit at the top is crushing the fruit at the bottom.
Yeah, and then that turns to juice, and that actually does start to undergo traditional fermentation. And that juice is also going to create CO2. So at one point, the tank doesn't need to be gassed anymore because the juice is creating the CO2 for you, and it's just kind of self-regulating.
So how long is this process? You know, like how long is it in the tank doing this kind of carbonic, CO2
it
fermentation?
It completely depends on what you're looking for in terms of the structure of the wine. The Marigny wines are somewhere between 7 and 11 or 12 days.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's pretty fast.
Yeah, and then they're crushed. Like we pull the tanks out. I have some really great partners now in the Marigny and they were able to help me get some proper tanks finally. You know, so we've got these larger format tanks that have a floating lid, and it sort of looks like a bicycle tire on the outside of it. So when the fruit is in there, we can put the lid at the very top, and you pump it up and fill it up with gas, and then we take the lid off. Interns will scoop the fruit out. I'm too big to get in the tank. And they, like, you know, you scoop the fruit out and you put it into the press and press the juice. And then while that first press cycle is happening, we wash out the tank and then hook the hoses from the press back to that tank and feed that pressed juice straight back into the original vessel. And then the fermentation finishes as like a normal fermentation, like a juice-based, oxygen-based fermentation.
Cool. And so how long is that? How long is that process?
That can be anywhere from like 2 weeks to several months sometimes.
Okay. And that just does that just depend on the conditions, like the temperature and the...
And sort of the chemistry of the juice, if there was enough nitrogen, yeast available nitrogen, all sorts of chemistry stuff that, because we don't use any sort of inoculant. We're only using native yeast that were in the fruit or in the cellar. And so it's sort of at its own pace.
So like we're hearing about this process of making the Marigny. What are you not adding to this, or what are you not doing as a part of this process that people are doing in kind of like larger scale, more commercial winemaking? Like I mean, in addition to the scale, like what is the difference of like technique? You know, it's like,
well, it's just nothing added, nothing taken away. I mean, obviously we're filling tanks with CO2.
Right. But when you say nothing added, taken away, I don't think that people really know that there are things added. Like you were just talking about yeast and that, like, you know, there are naturally occurring yeast that are in the air, that are like on the grapes, whatever, that will
us.
Like everything will ferment itself given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. But you know, a commercial winemaker is oftentimes adding yeasts.
It's more control, essentially. And what we're doing is essentially stepping away and removing controls to hopefully get a result that is a little more fantastical and surprising. So lab-based yeast, which is essentially...
Would you just like buy online or something
like
that?
It's a culture. It usually comes out of a vineyard, like Montrachet yeast. You know, they've gone into this vineyard in France and they have pulled their strongest cultures and, like, you know, culture after culture after culture got the thing so strong that it will ferment through anything, through high alcohol, through low temperatures, etc.
Gotcha.
Acids, tartaric acid is grape acid.
So people will add additional acid to the wines just kind of on its own.
If you need acidity, acid adds are pretty common. You can deacidify a wine with potassium bicarbonate. And all this stuff sounds probably a little scarier than it is.
Right.
There's essentially three phases of winemakers. There's people like me that are no controls. And there are winemakers that are still very hands-on and have beautiful vineyards and are trying to make something that is completely controlled. And essentially has things in it that's no different than, you know, eating a pack of gummy bears.
Right.
For me, the main thing is keeping the vineyards organic, farming them with high intention, understanding that is... the people that are most affected by that are the people that live in the communities around those vineyards and the people that farm them.
Right.
Drinking one bottle of wine that from a vineyard that has been sprayed is not the end of the world. Sitting on a tractor all day long and spraying a vineyard certainly can be.
Right. So there's kind of like an ethical, I mean, I think that to me is like when I start thinking about natural wine, I'm like, there is also like an ethic to it.
Absolutely.
You know, that you're like, oh, I don't want somebody to be like harvesting in a field full of pesticides. I don't want somebody like driving their tractor through a farm and, you know, being exposed to like all of these carcinogens.
Absolutely. Like, I'm much more concerned with the social justice aspect of it than I am with the dogma of the cellar.
Right.
You know, although I'm very hands-off, there's no additions in the wines aside from a slight SO2 sulfur addition at bottling. we're much more concerned with getting the vineyards right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That makes sense. I mean, you know, you don't want to shit where you drink.
No.
All right. Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Let's go get something to drink.
Let's do it.
Okay, thanks to Emil and Andy. And now here I am with Chris Morocco talking spicy sweet sambal pork noodles. All right, Chris, not to get all Marvel Comics on you, but let's talk about the origin story behind your spicy sweet sambal pork noodles.
A rainy night, a loner. No, so this is actually born of the meeting that you called where we talked about recipe names. Mm. And starting out like kind of, you know, in the food world a long time ago, I think I sort of thought about recipes in this like clear, linear nuts and bolts kind of way. And for a while, our naming conventions for recipes were very much like, oh, seared chicken with lemon oregano pan sauce and dot, dot, dot,
They were very literal, and they often mentioned like five of the nine ingredients in there. I'm like, do we need to mention every herb in this recipe in the title?
And you really pushed us to take a step back from that, which I think, you know, in some ways we already had, but to really like take a couple steps back from that and ask ourselves, what would be the recipes, you know, that we would try to sell people on, you know, without a picture, without any kind of clear descriptors, you know, or anything that's like quite as literal as, you know, we've been known to get in the past. What would that look like? What would those recipe names sound like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, a recipe name is kind of like the headline for a story. Does it grab your attention? Does it make you want to read it? And especially as we all know in this day and age of social media where there's so much out there pinging around and either something grabs you or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And either you keep swiping through or you stop. And I guess with editors and recipe developers now, how do we get people to stop more and actually read the recipe and cook it?
Yeah. So we sat down, right? And we created a list of, I mean, I don't know, dozens of recipe names, you know, just not necessarily thinking about the actual like granular detail of like what all the recipes would be, but just like what would be the things that we would want to say. So this started out as Drunken Bolognese.
I like all of that. Immediately, I'm like, yes and yes.
And it's funny to see the evolution that this recipe actually went through, right? Because that's not what it came out being named. And I think this process sort of showed like, you know, kind of like a lot of the dynamics that kind of go into how you create a recipe, you know, how you create a dish, but then how you sell that recipe. And so it started out Drunken Bolognese because I simply sat there and said, okay, I love the idea of like a rich kind of one pot, meaty kind of comfort sauce. But why does bolognese always have to be this really specific thing?
Mm-hmm. From a particular region in Italy with right. a particular set of ingredients.
Right, which even then it's like, well, I mean, you know, bolognese in Italian, you know, could mean any kind of, you know, different things to different people on different sides of Bologna, right? But I think I wanted to kind of take a few steps back from that and sort of say, okay, well, what if we threw some soy sauce in it? What if we, you know, made it a little spicier and sweeter? Bolognese kind of means this rich, long-simmered, you know, meat sauce from a particular place, but what if we could just sort of reinvent it and think of it as something else, and what would that be? And then I overlaid on that, you know, my love of pad ke mao or drunken noodles. It's kind of like that Thai noodle dish that isn't pad Thai. It's like, you know, usually you'll see it like on the menu.
And yeah, so describe drunken noodles for someone who hasn't had it.
Yeah, so it's kind of a modest amount of ground meat, usually pork. It's often got like a dark sweet soy sauce, holy basil or Thai basil. It's got chili, so it's, you know, kind of super fragrant, kind of meat-based noodle stir fry, if you will. And very sort of strong like soy and like oyster sauce often component, fish sauce. So it's really, really assertive. I just wanted to kind of create a marriage, you know, with this sort of drunken bolognese, if you will, of these two kind of sauces that I really, you know, love and have a huge fondness for.
So you started with a clear idea, but then as often happens, you end up going on a journey somewhere that you might not have expected. So what was that process like in terms of like, all right, I know what I want to make. and then you start making it and you kind of end up over here instead of over there.
Right. So, I mean, drunken bolognese, you know, I wanted that dish to inform kind of my pantry ingredients for this. So I started pulling out stuff like oyster sauce, soy sauce, and I started pulling out, you know, all kinds of fresh chilies. But I realized I wanted to create something that was, that could lean on more pantry staples. So stuff that wasn't like really esoteric at all. And frankly, you know, kind of avoiding fish sauce, just because I think it would make this such a specific dish that not everybody might appreciate. So instead of doing the fresh chilies, I ended up going with sambal oleg, you know, just that like kind of like mildly fermenty, you know, chili paste.
You can find it at most any decent grocery store these days. And I think it's, I would say it's kind of a cousin to sriracha. For those of you who obviously know sriracha, it comes in a jar, but it's a, I mean, it's great on eggs, it's great on sandwich, it's great on anything. It's kind of a sweet, spicy chili sauce.
Yeah, and you can use a lot of it, which is nice. It's spicy, but it's not, I mean, I think we call for a third of a cup in this. So you can get a ton of chili flavor and richness and body into this dish without making it kind of overwhelmingly spicy. So I think I kind of had to dial in, you know, the pantry staples that I wanted to lean on for this. But I knew that I wanted to make a sauce that, unlike, you know, Pad Khi Mao, where you have like a modest amount of ground pork, I wanted to do something that felt like and looked like bolognese, you know, big torn leaves of basil, perhaps, you know, if it's in season, or, you know, a little bit of tomato paste for the, like that rich kind of color and a little bit of extra umami. So, yeah, it all kind of, you know, ended up kind of coming together just as I kind of simplified the ingredients, figured out the process, and, you know, kind of immediately like entered into that sort of stumbling block of, okay, like now I have 2 pounds of meat, you know, 2 pounds of meat, you know, worth of sauce, and I want to brown it. And how should I do that? You know, and in the past, like we've talked about, like, you know, do you form balls and brown the balls off? Or, you know, in this case, I just literally ripped chunks of ground meat, threw it into a large saucepan or small pot, and, you know, just at least browned half of it.
Okay, so are we getting into the step-by-step
We're getting into specifics. Okay. Just to walk you through it.
So we're getting into step-by-step. So, all right, we end up with the recipe name, spicy sweet sambal pork noodles. So you say, and I'm going to read this because this was something that sort of piqued my curiosity in a couple of reader comments as well. You know, you can heat the oil in a large heavy pot, yada, yada. Add half of pork to pot, breaking apart into 6 to 8 large chunks with a wooden spoon. Cook undisturbed until well-browned underneath, about 5 minutes. Okay, makes sense. Turn pieces and continue to cook, turning occasionally until pork is browned on 2 to 3 sides. I like that, about 5 minutes longer. Then you add some fresh ginger, garlic, sugar, and remaining pork to pot and cook, breaking up into small clumps until meat is nearly cooked through. And then you add the tomato paste, etc. Okay, so why explain the divide of the pork
back.
Yes. So you do half the pork brown first, and then you add everything else in.
Right.
So why?
So my thinking is this: you really honestly cannot brown 2 pounds of pork at once, you know, and already, not that this is a super steppy,
meaning that it just kind of steams and cooks in its own fat, but doesn't get brown.
If you just dump it into the pot, it's just going to kind of get steamy.
Yeah.
That first side might get a little bit of color, but as soon as you flip it, it's going to be like water.
See, I've had this, we did another podcast for BA's Best Bolognese with one of our very own Andy Baragani, and talked about this whole browning process as well. I've had that problem before, but didn't realize why I was having that problem before. But good home cooks or chefs or whatnot will always talk about, quote unquote, don't crowd the pan.
Yeah.
And if you want to brown something, if you want caramelization, you need some space in the pan so there's not excess moisture. There needs to be room to brown.
Dissipate, yeah.
All right, so you're browning half of it. That allows you to get some caramelization on the meat.
Because it's better to get great caramelization and get all those Maillard reactions on at least half of the meat.
And the flavor really wakens up.
Flavor, yeah. Oh, I mean, you know, the flavor development and the intensification, you know, and the benefit you get from having some of the meat really browned. The fact that, like, the remainder of the meat, it doesn't brown, you know, that second pound
of meat.
So
it'll cook through, obviously, when it's in the cooking, braising process. But not everything needs to brown. All right, so you have the browning flavor. You add the ginger, the garlic, whatnot. Chili paste, soy sauce, vinegar, 2 cups water, bring to a simmer, reduce heat to low, and cook uncovered and stirring occasionally until sauce is slightly thickened and flavors have melded, about 45 minutes. So One question we
had. I kind of hate that word meld, but you know,
we're kind of like that.
Really? Yeah. I feel like because there's no clear, like, oh, it went from being like raw to cooked. I mean, obviously it's already cooked, but it's this subjective, like, oh, it's melded.
Yeah.
I feel like oops, people must just sit there and be like, Chris, you.
All right. So this is like kind of just recipe talk in general. I don't want to say it annoys me because a large degree of cooking should be left up to the cook and that cook's intuition and understanding when something smells done or feels done.
Yeah,
or,
empowering them.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this notion of recipes, everyone wants them to be exact. Well, is it 13 minutes or 16 minutes? I'm like, depends on the oven, depends on the size of the pan. There is no exact time. And sometimes it's done when it's done. And like you kind of have to trust yourself and taste it. If it doesn't taste quite there, let it go a little bit more and reduce a bit more. So we have this 45-minute sort of braising period with all the ingredients in there. For a while, the name kicking around the office was Sambalagnese, kind of as a shortcut name.
I put that out there.
And what happened? Maybe,
well, I think, you know, everybody got really tripped up around the idea of like what is bolognese and what isn't bolognese. And I think they just felt like this is not bolognese.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, and I'm curious like what you think about this, because for me, you know, I know we get into trouble sometimes when we kind of like, you know, claim like any kind of like, you know, kind of expert position on food that like we're just not, you know.
And anything suggestion authenticity will elicit a rash of responses on the Twitter and whatnot. And understand, I get it. And it's like, there's a lot, that opens up a whole other discussion. But, and I guess with bolognese, you could, is there milk in there? No. Is there Parmesan cheese? No. Does it go
My
for three
like,
hours? No. Does it look like bolognese when I look at the picture, which is gorgeous by our photographer, Chelsea Craig? I'm like, looks like bolognese. You could call it that and be fine. But the question is, do you want to have to explain it and defend it and whatnot?
Line of inquiry,
ultimately,
yeah.
Probably not.
Probably not, right? So we had drunken noodles became sambolognese, which then became spicy sweet sambal pork noodles.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I mean, people seem to be into it, and, you know, it certainly is delicious, and it's the same dish it always, you know, kind of was or was bound to become. But yeah, it definitely took a journey.
So a couple questions about the recipe itself. First of all, we call for 2 pounds of ground pork and 16 ounces of either fresh ramen noodles or spaghetti. So why 2 pounds? Why not one? Why eight? How do we decide on the 6 to 8 serving size?
Right. Well, I kind of wanted to just go big because I feel like with anything like, you know, not that this is cooking for as long as like a regular bolognese would, because, you know, we're relying on these ingredients that already have a ton of flavor development having happened in the past, right? So like soy sauce, it's fermented. It ferments for however many months. So you get all the benefit of adding that ingredient and all of the flavor development that's happened along the way, right? So the cook time is actually relatively minimal. You know,
because you have these ingredients that already have a depth of flavor.
They've had a massive head start in the flavor department. Exactly. Whereas traditional bolognese, you know, you need the cooking process to really kind of draw out all those flavors. Going back to, you know, just like traditional bolognese, if you're going to go through the effort, you know, to make this, you might as well just make double. You know, it's not that I think everybody's going to necessarily want 6 to 8 portions of it at like one time, but you're already making this, you know, and it's going to freeze or it's going to hang out in the fridge for, you know, beautifully for days. So why not just make more? And, you know, the fact of, you know, wanting to kind of like frame it as this kind of like hybrid bolognese, you know, but with like these kind of like cool, like Thai, Asian, whatever flavors. We wanted to kind of have the option of shooting it with ramen noodles, or, you know, we tried it with ramen noodles, you know, in development, and we also tried it just with regular spaghetti. And it was awesome with both.
You can find fresh ramen noodles a lot more nowadays. They come in different size packs. But 1 pound of dried spaghetti, is there a reason we call for more fresh ramen than we do dried pasta?
The yields come out to be some like pretty close to being the same, just because a fresh noodle is already, you know, hydrated, right? So it absorbs less liquid as it cooks.
Look at you.
Whereas the dried pasta absorbs more water as it cooks, so it kind of shakes out similarly.
So, you know? So a pound of dried once it's all cooked, feels closer to a pound and a half of fresh.
I think I originally tried calling for 18 ounces, and people put the smack down on that.
Chris is.
They're like, 16 ounces sounds fine, Chris.
Chris is definitely the most exacting member of our test kitchen staff. I thought one reader on the .com had a good question about his daughter is gluten-free, can you use rice noodles. I would
Absolutely.
Assume rice noodles would be great.
Fantastic, yeah.
Just like you would not want to use like the vermicelli, the really angel hairy one, thicker one. Also, Alex Beggs, our writer here at Bon Appetit, when she was testing the recipe and writing about it, she used Korean rice cakes, which I love, and they're kind of squishy and starchy and squeaky and the little like sort of nubs of
gloriously
of rice,
chewy
flour or cake sort of things, and those are great, especially with a typical sort of spicy red sauce of some sort.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that idea.
My wife and I will have this week. I'm gonna go with the ramen noodles probably, just because again they're accessible now. I eat enough regular dried Italian pasta in my life. I need to mix it up,
but don't forget the butter at the end, even with the Asian flavors.
So,
soy,
yeah.
butter, sambal, oh, it's all good.
Yeah, same technique as we often call for, a little pasta water, a little butter, sort of create that silky glossiness at the end.
Absolutely.
All right, you can find this recipe on bonappetit.com. It is, can you give me the correct name, Chris? Go
Spicy,
ahead.
Spicy sweet sambal pork noodles.
Thank you, Chris Morocco.
Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.